Okay, we have on the live line here, Dick Becker from, you're from, the, now what's the, describe the project that you're working on now.
This is the Iraq Sanctions Challenge, is the particular project. It was initiated by the International Action Center, but it's been joined in with by many organizations, including IFCO, Pastors for Peace, the Iraq Action Coalition, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Voices in the Wilderness. Many, I would say most of the organizations that over the last several years have been working on the issue of the sanctions against Iraq, along with many other individuals and organizations, including the people from Ohio State, are going to be going. John Strange, who was the guy who asked Madeleine Albright the famous question, how come you have a double standard for U.S. foreign policy? And Madeleine Albright said, you don't understand politics. I'll give you a 50-minute lecture later. The one that was captured and shown all over the world, he's going to be going. There's about 75 to 100 people. We're not sure the final number yet, but at least 75 people and probably closer to 100 people are going to be going to Jordan a week from tomorrow on May 6th and taking with us millions of dollars worth of life-saving medicine. This is going to be the largest delegation to go from the United States to Iraq since the Gulf War. Another delegation, including Ramsey Clark, is going to be going from Damascus. They're going to be going to Beirut and then overland to Damascus, Syria, and then from there to Baghdad and also taking medicine. And these groups are going to converge in Baghdad on the 8th of May, and we're going to be distributing the medicines in Iraq to hospitals, and also the project has two main points to it. One is that we want to take this medicine that can save the lives of tens of thousands of people who are dying as a result of the sanctions. And at the same time, we want to expose the fact that the sanctions remain in place and are killing 300 Iraqis every day, half of them children under the age of five, because of the insistence of the United States government. So we feel it's very important that this is a group coming from within the United States of many religious and labor and community student leaders who are openly challenging this policy. We're not asking the U.S. government for a license to do this. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens next week.
Now, in organizing this, how long have you did it take to raise this much medical equipment and support? It sounds like several years' work.
Well, it's in fact several weeks' work.
That's amazing. That's
incredible. Kind of amazing. This kind of project, people usually spend about 6 months getting ready to do it. But we felt that when the bombing crisis, died down and in late February, and we had been organizing many demonstrations and teach-ins and so forth, as had many other organizations, that it was very important that we not let the momentum go, particularly around the issue of sanctions, because while the issue of Iraq went off the front pages and even off the back pages for a while, the war against the Iraqi people never stopped. And the war has taken the form of sanctions, which have killed six or seven times as many people as the bombing did back in 1991. So we felt that it was very important to not let this issue slip away. And we had a meeting on March 21st in New York City where about 300 people came from all over the country, a national planning, emergency planning meeting, and the outcome of that was the Iraq Sanctions Challenge, and everybody who came to that meeting agreed this is the thing to do. Let's up the ante, let's really put it on the line, and let's say we're going to go, we're going to take this medicine, we're going to expose who's really behind keeping the sanctions in place. And the people who are going on the delegation, which includes Reverend Lucius Walker from Pastors for Peace, Ramsey Clark, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, who's the Bishop of Detroit, Gloria LaRiva, who's an activist here in San Francisco, Kathy Kelly from Chicago, and many more, they are all running the risk of being prosecuted by the U.S. government for doing this, because they're engaging in what the Treasury Department calls trading with the enemy by delivering unauthorized medical supplies and making an unauthorized trip to Iraq. If the government decides that they want to put people on trial, if they want to arrest and put on trial the people who are going on the trip, our attitude toward that is that we will put the U.S. government on trial for a policy which is really a policy of genocide. It's now killed well over 1.5 million Iraqis and a population of about 22 million.
So why do you think that the United States government, which is supposed to be this great human rights government, has embarked on this policy that has resulted in so many deaths?
Well, the real reasons for it are very different than those that are given. This crisis, this latest crisis that happened in January and February, really had nothing to do with what the ostensible reasons were, what the media reasons were. It didn't have to do with chemical and biological weapons. It didn't have to do with presidential sites in Iraq. It didn't have to do with compliance with UN resolutions. That was all fodder for the public relations mill. And U.S. officials themselves said so, that they knew that Iraq really isn't a threat to anybody, that they don't really have weapons of mass destruction anymore. The UN team that went and surveyed the presidential sites that we all heard so much about, and which Clinton had claimed one of them was as big as the District of Columbia, 60 square miles. Well, it turned out that all of them put together were 12 square miles, and about a third of that was made up of lakes, and the rest was made up of buildings, and they were empty, and when they went and examined them, there was nothing there. So what's it really about? It's about domination. It's about the U.S. government acting on who it really represents, on behalf of who it really represents, the oil companies, the banks, the military-industrial complex, really asserting their domination over the region of the world they consider to be the most strategic, and that's the Gulf region, the Middle East, because of its geopolitical position, but most importantly because it contains within it two-thirds of the world's proven petroleum reserves. That translates not only into immense profits. We're not just talking about oil as oil, but oil as oil profits. Translates into great profits. It translates into great influence over the rest of the world on the part of whoever controls that key region. And this is what's really the bottom line. This is what really is driving U.S. policy in the Gulf.
Yeah, and now, do you see, in going over there, now, how did the Iraqi government respond? Did they, like, say, oh, well, you know, you got to get all these visas and all this stuff? Or how was that arranged?
Well, we have gone through the normal processes that you do to obtain visas. And, of course, you do have to obtain visas. But certainly the attitudes are very different. I think that the Iraqi government, as well as the Iraqi people, are looking to people in the world, people around the world who understand what a horrific policy the sanctions are. I mean, the sanctions is a polite word for the most total blockade of any country in modern history. And they're looking for people around the world who understand this and who want to help end the sanctions. So I think that the delegation and what it's bringing, this life-saving medicine, is going to be welcomed by people in Iraq.
And that will there be like meetings with the health officials of Iraq or anything like that?
Yeah, the delegation, this large delegation that's going, will probably break up into smaller groups and will be delivering medicine and medical supplies to hospitals. For people who don't know, we've produced a video here from our delegation, Ramsey Clark and Gloria LaRiva and others who went back in November, a video called Genocide by Sanctions that shows that there's nothing in the hospitals anymore. They not only don't have medicine, they don't have sutures, they don't have anesthesia, they can't perform operations, they don't even have the wherewithal to clean the floors or put sheets on the beds anymore. That's how bad it is. And the same goes for schools. The schools have deteriorated terribly, and there's no notebooks, there's no textbooks, pencils, pens. And this is a country that had a universal health care and universal education system that were the envy of the entire Arab world and much of the developing world before the sanctions were put into place. This has been a catastrophe, but it's a human-made catastrophe that's taken place in Iraq. And it's not only those who have died, but the living who are suffering, and because of this policy, will suffer for many years to come, even if the sanctions were to be lifted now. I think we all know that as of yesterday, at the UN Security Council, the U.S. insisted that the sanctions remain in place, and no vote was actually taken because it was clear that the United States would veto any change in the status of the sanctions.
Do you know of any countries that are defying these sanctions?
Well, no country is openly defying them because the way that the sanctions have been set up, any country that openly traded with Iraq would itself be then subject to sanctions and could face similar kinds of penalties against it. But the surrounding countries, and we're going, our main delegation is going to Jordan and then going overland because all civilian air traffic in or out of Iraq has been banned since the Gulf War as part of the sanctions. We're going to Jordan, and we expect and hear that we're going to be welcomed in Jordan by members of the parliament, of the Jordanian parliament, and leading figures in the media. 99% of the people in Jordan and 99% of the people throughout the Arab world consider what is happening to the Iraqi people to be an outrageous injustice, and it's one that has stirred great anger all over the Arab world and many other parts of the world as well. So there's a great desire on the part of the people of many countries, to end the sanctions, to allow the Iraqi people to live, to let Iraq live as a country and to come back to life. Because the situation there is not only that people are lacking food and medicine, everything is breaking down, and most critically, as an article in yesterday's San Francisco Examiner shows, it really comes from the London Independent but was reprinted, that there's no more clean drinking water in Iraq. The water comes from the rivers, the raw sewage goes into the rivers, the sewage treatment is broken down, there's no spare parts to replace it, there's no money to replace it, and the water treatment facilities have broken down. So this is a catastrophe in every respect, and it's recognized by people all over the world.
So it could be that in the next few years, if the sanctions aren't lifted, that maybe hundreds of thousands of more people will perish because of the U.S. policy.
Well, if the sanctions aren't ended, we estimate that about 120 to 150,000 people will die every year. But I think that what you're getting at is very true. This could develop into a much greater catastrophe. Iraq has extremely hot weather in the summertime. And with the water treatment, see, they repaired the water treatment systems and sewage treatment systems to a certain degree after the Gulf War. But now the sanctions, 8 years of sanctions, it'll be 8 years in August, have and being banned from importing spare parts, banned from importing chlorine to purify water, banned from exporting and importing virtually everything. Those systems have once again broken down, and there's no more spare parts. There can be no more cannibalizing of equipment to keep things going. There could be terrible epidemics in Iraq. There could be cholera epidemics, typhus epidemics, and there's no medicine to treat those now. So you have the stage set. Unless the sanctions policy is overturned, the stage is set for an even more terrible catastrophe, and one in which the death toll could soar into the millions.
Wow. Now, are the neighboring countries also concerned about the... Because once you have these huge epidemics, they don't just stop at the border. There's no, like, border patrol to stop.
That's right.
And so has there been a public outcry about the possibility of this?
Well, you have a situation where the countries that immediately border Iraq are Jordan, where King Hussein, who's been on the CIA payroll on and off ever since he became king in the early 1950s. Kuwait, which is a protectorate of the United States, formerly a colony of Britain, it passed directly from being a colony of Britain into being a protectorate of the United States. Saudi Arabia, whose borders were created by the United States. Turkey, which is the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid on the north, is a country that is very closely aligned with the United States and is a member of NATO. And the borders is is Iran. And Iran and Iraq, unfortunately, have had their own...
Like border, their own border disputes?
Yeah, they've had their own conflicts.
Right. Whoop, we're kind of losing you there.
No, are we here?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, now, so you're going to have a send-off on May 6th, you said?
No, May
2nd. May 2nd. Oh, and you're arriving on May 6th in Baghdad. That's the story, I mean, in Jordan. And can you tell us where the send-off will be?
Yeah, we're going to be having, we're having send-off events all over the country where people are organizing really utilizing this opportunity to raise the issue of the sanctions in hundreds of communities across the country. And here we're going to be having a send-off event on Saturday, May 2nd, and it's going to be taking place at the Cap Street Center, which is 362 Cap Street. It's between 18th and 19th Street, and Cap is one block east of Mission. There are going to be people speaking there who will be going on the delegation from here. Speakers will include Malik Rahim, Gloria LaRiva, Barbara Lubin, who just returned from Iraq with the delegation a few days ago, Ilyas Reshmawi from the Committee for a Democratic Palestine, Mansour Ghori, who's with the American Muslims for Global Peace and Justice, and he's also going to be part of this delegation. So this should be a very informative and very powerful event, and we really hope people will come out to it. It's at the Cap Street Center at 362 Cap. And they can call, if they want more information, they can call us here in San Francisco at 821-6545. And that's the International Action Center. It's also in directory assistance.
Now, when everybody comes back, if they are prosecuted, what are they facing?
Well, they face heavy charges. They face the possibility of charges that could bring up to 12 years in prison and $1 million fines. And this is under the Trading with the Enemy Act, which bans, the State Department considers it, and the U.S. government considers its right to prevent people from traveling to certain countries, Iraq, Cuba, Libya, North Korea, Iran, and they can bring charges against you, federal charges that carry very heavy prison terms and fines and so forth. They have not done that up until now with other delegations that have traveled to Iraq, including our own delegations and the Voices in the Wilderness delegations. But it appears to us that the political situation is heating up again. And if you just follow what's being said in the media the last few days, and more attention being directed again to Iraq without any real change in the situation, but just more allegations being made against Iraq, against the government of Iraq, emanating from the U.S. government, is a sign to us that the situation may be intensifying. And our delegation, this large delegation, is going to be going just as that's happening. So it'll be very interesting to see. The U.S. government, at the same time, feels a lot of sensitivity about the issue of the sanctions, and they're trying to find ways to divert attention from themselves and to divert the blame onto somebody else and making all kinds of really ludicrous charges. They also, I think, arranged to have a plane load of medicine fly to Baghdad the other day, sent by AmeriCares. And this is part of trying to cover themselves to say, oh, look, we're helping, we're trying to help the people of Iraq. Madeleine Albright recently said that the U.S. has been the biggest contributor to humanitarian aid to Iraq since the Gulf War, which is absolutely ludicrous. The U.S. government itself has given nothing in the way of support to the people of Iraq.
Well, it seems crazy to be saying that, and then you've got sanctions, and then
right.
And they're an enemy, and they're bad and evil, and then they have... Now I caught a little bit of that Madeleine Albright town meeting in Columbus, Ohio, you know, and she was saying that that Iraq is the only country to use weapons of mass destruction against its own people and so on, and... you know, how true is that? Maybe it's splitting hairs, but it seems like the U.S. has killed a lot of its own people. Maybe, I don't know if it used weapons of so-called mass destruction to do that, but then they showed, like, this picture of what looked like a baby dying in Hiroshima, supposed to have been a Kurdish person dying from I guess, chemical weapons that were sold to Iraq by the U.S. and then used against their own people. Although, it's, you know, maybe these were their chemical weapons sold by some other country and used against their own people. But, you know, how true is all this? Is this like the... is he really the, like, Saddam Hussein is the most murderous person, killing more people? It seems to me that when you start to look at these sanctions, that maybe Saddam Hussein's tied with Bill Clinton.
Well, there's a lot of different aspects of this, I think. And one is this, that in the late 1970s, when Saddam Hussein became the president of Iraq, there was a kind of coalition government between the left, the Communist Party, and the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, and some other elements. And in the late 70s, that broke up when the Ba'athist Party leadership turned on the Communist Party and drove them out of the government and drove them killed a lot of people in the Communist Party and drove them underground, basically crushed them as a party. This made the United States very happy. And I think it also opened up a particular period that of collaboration, of more collaboration. It was a signal to the U.S. It was the government in Iraq at the time wanted to have more relations, and the U.S. then in turn encouraged Iraq to attack Iran in 1980, right after the revolution in Iran, which knocked out the Shah, who had been the pivot and the base for U.S. operations in the Gulf ever since he had been put in power by a CIA coup in 1953. But the real objective of the United States, and this is something that we need to be very clear about, has nothing to do with friendship for Iranians or Iraqis or anybody in the Middle East, including Jewish people. And they're not friendly to any of the people. I think it was Fidel Castro once said the great powers have no friends, they have only interests. And that's something to always remember. And when the world situation changed in the late 1980s, and the disintegration and then collapse of the Soviet Union, the U.S. saw an opportunity not just to weaken Iran, not just to weaken Iraq, but to turn back the clock of history. Now, in 1958, there had been a revolution in Iraq, and the U.S. had the Baghdad Pact, its anti-communist, anti-Arab nationalist military alliance had been based in Iraq, and that the Iraqi revolution had overturned that. And the U.S. had been waiting ever since then for new circumstances to arise that would allow it to reverse what had happened in 1958. So they were very happy for certain things that Saddam Hussein's government did, and they opened up trade and military relations and so forth, the repression of the left, the attack on Iran and so forth. But what they really wanted was to knock out the whole structure that had arisen from that revolution in 58. And while Saddam Hussein might have been collaborative with them on certain issues, that wasn't all that they wanted. What they really wanted was to take Iraq back. Iraq has 10% of the world's oil. Iraq, along with Iran, are the two countries in the Gulf region that not only have oil, but they also have water and relatively large populations, meaning that they can be independent countries. This is considered to be the worst thing for U.S. interests. They want little broken-up emirates like Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, countries that really are going to take their orders from Washington and their orders from the oil companies and turn over their resources and turn over their countries to foreign interests. So that's what we really think this is about. This is what's really been driving the policy. And that's aside from the point of whether at certain times the Iraqi government has done things that we disagree with or find reprehensible. Certainly that has been true. But that is not... those things have been what have made Washington happy in the past.
Right. Cause, now, I recall that there was one point where a commercial airline was shot down by the United States. And... nothing really happened as a result of that, and then you move along to another. It was like revealed that during that period of time that the United States was providing intelligence information, satellite information for the Iraqi military against Iran, and then there, as time went on, there became this whole incident with April Glaspie, who was who gave the said, "Oh, there won't be any possibility if the Iraq invades Kuwait, there won't be any retaliation." And you, and I remember George Bush, I guess, had had just signed a $10 billion agricultural agreement with Iraq at that time, and then 12 months later, roughly, you, or I'm not sure how many more months later, we end up with the actual Gulf War buildup and so on. Can you refresh our minds on that, how we ended up in a war, in this the current war with Iraq?
Well, it's very interesting what happened. And the point you started with about the shootdown of the passenger plane, that was interesting because a U.S. ship... I think it was the Stark, the USS Stark.
Right, it was the Stark, right.
Had been hit by an Iraqi missile, and I think it resulted in the death of 29 U.S. military personnel, something like that. And it was said by the Iraqis, and this was probably true, to have been an accident. You know, all these U.S. Ships were there in the middle of a combat zone. The Iran-Iraq war was going on. This was still in 1987. The war had been going on for almost 7 years. And the U.S. responded to this, not by attacking Iraq, but a few days later shooting down this Iranian Airbus. And afterwards they said, well, they made a mistake. They didn't really mean to shoot down this passenger plane. But it was traveling on a regular route over the Gulf. And I believe something like 254 people were killed, mostly, but not all Iranians, but people from a number of different countries. And there was really very little that was done about that. And, of course, there were no sanctions against the United States, which is interesting when you think about some other countries that have received sanctions, like Libya. Libya, because it supposedly won't give up two people who someone suspects of being involved in a plane crash in Lockerbie, Scotland. But now this was a direct act by the U.S., by the U.S. military, of shooting down this passenger plane. And that was an act of terrorism, we believe, against Iran in the war. And it led, in a certain way, to a year later, the war ending. The other second point that you mentioned is about the fact that the United States supplied aerial satellite photography to the Iraqi Air Force to use in its targeting of Iranian targets. That was absolutely true. At the same time, what the Iran-Contra affair brought out was that the U.S., through Israel, was selling Iran anti-aircraft missiles. In other words, they were helping both sides, and objective was expressed by Henry Kissinger, who, although he wasn't still Secretary of State, is always sort of the shadow Secretary of State, and I asked on one talk show, what do you think about the Iran-Iraq war? He said, I hope they kill each other. So the objective has been to destroy both of those countries. What led directly to the Gulf War, we believe, was, number one, this collapsing of the Soviet Union, which left the U.S. as the single power, the single superpower in the world. And that was already becoming the case by 1990, even though the Soviet Union didn't formally collapse until a year later. And at the same time, the end of the Iran-Iraq war was seen in a certain way by U.S. officials as being unfortunate. They wanted the war to continue and both countries to weaken each other. They began to prepare, we know, as soon as the Iran-Iraq war ended in 1988, for military action against Iraq. In 1989 and 90, what led up to the war was a provocative policy by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, but particularly by Kuwait, a country which Iraq has always disputed its legitimacy and said that it's really an amputated part of Iraq, should be really considered a part of Iraq. But Kuwait pursued a policy of overselling oil on the world market above its quota and at the same time stealing Iraqi oil using slant drilling equipment. In many international and Arab pan-Arab meetings that took place in conferences over about a year, Iraq repeatedly warned Kuwait that it was engaging in economic warfare. It was saying, Kuwait, you are engaging, the warfare can take many forms, but a very devastating form is economic warfare, And for every dollar that the price of oil goes down on the world market, we lose $1 billion a year. We're recovering from a war. This is devastating our economy. You have to stop this. The April Glaspie incident that you refer to is after Kuwait had ignored these warnings, repeatedly ignored these warnings, a few days before Iraqi troops went into Kuwait, Saddam Hussein met with April Glaspie, then the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and said to her, "This is our, you know, we have this grave problem. What is the attitude of the U.S. government toward what is going on between Kuwait and Iraq?" And April Glaspie replied, "That's your business. It's not up to us." And that was taken to mean that the U.S. didn't have a position. Now, of course, the U.S. did have a position. Undoubtedly, Kuwait would not have engaged in this provocative behavior against a country that was far... Kuwait is a very small country. It has a Kuwaiti population of about 300,000.